the most formidable engine of war the world has ever seen. Doctor, I will not be troublesome with a wealth of details, but it seems to me that there is a fair analogy here between a well-enclosed estate directed by men of education with capital and the usual village of small holdings and an immense, largely unproductive common. We are, after all, at war. And though this one may soon be over, above all, if we can keep the French bottled up in Brest, there's sure to be another presently. Foreigners are never to be trusted. Look at Spain, for example, with us, against us, and now with us again until it suits their purpose to turn cat in pan once more. And with the present system, we simply do not grow enough corn. We do not produce enough meat to feed the navy, the army, and the civilians. It seems to me, and to many men of goodwill, that just as it was the duty of the Spartans to bring up their young men to arms, so it is our duty to bring up farmers to feed the fighting men. Farmers with 200 or 300 acres, often carved out of unproductive common. There's no room for sentiment in wartime. And after all, your village Streffens with an open pipe weren't very valuable creatures, if indeed they ever existed. I never came across any. There. Forgive me, Doctor. I've explained myself very badly, I'm afraid. But if you could put that point of view to your shipmate, particularly the image of a first-rate in capital order on the one hand, and a straggling village with pothouses, small holdings, and more poachers, half of them on the parish, than farmhands, I believe you would act as a friend. I cannot do it myself. Not only am I an interested party, but in my disappointment at his news, I used some unguarded terms, and Griffiths is quite incapable. Yet this is a time when sailors as well as neighbours should stand together. Victory, if it come, he rapped the tabletop, will be very welcome, but it'll be a hard time for the service, with ships being paid off by the hundred, half pay for almost everybody, and precious few commands. A time when a well-placed friend may prove... He didn't finish his sentence, but coughed. And his commanding old face, unused to such an expression, took on a look of acute embarrassment. I'm afraid I've been wearisome, Doctor, that I beg your pardon. But this is a point, a duty, as I see it, upon which I feel very strongly indeed. You'll say that I'm personally concerned, which is very true. Yet I think I may place my hand on my heart and assert that I should be of the same opinion if neither I nor my nephew possessed an acre of land. Still, I know what assertions are worth, and I shall bore you no longer, except to observe that my secretary has some messages for you. He rang a bell, told the servant to pass the word for Mr. Craddock, and said, Doctor, thank you for listening to me so patiently. I shall leave you and Craddock together. And with a slight bow, he walked out of the cabin. Jack, said Stephen, when they were back in the Bellona's great cabin, I admire your fortitude in making no reply. One of the first things one learns in the service is that any reply to a superior officer, any justification, protest and counter-accusation is absolutely useless. And if the superior wishes to destroy you, it's the best possible way of helping him to do so. Now, it's a poor, shabby thing to blackguard a man who cannot answer. But I believe he was vexed to the very heart. He was, too, said Stephen. And they sat in silence for a while. It was a pleasant day, and the squadron, now well south of the Black Rocks, was standing across the bay under an easy sail, heading for the Saints, that deadly chain of reefs upon which so many ships had been wrecked. "We're going to pass through the Ras de Seine," said Jack, "and then the Admiral will haul his wind and rejoin the offshore squadron west of Ushant, leaving us with the Ramillies, a couple of frigates and a cutter or so. They'll look in from time to time, perhaps bringing reinforcements. Presently I'll show you Dead Man's Bay and the Pointe du Raz. Stephen gazed over the sea at the distant mainland. He felt the agreeable heave of the southwest swell, and he said, "Here's space, here's air, the vast sweep of the ocean, this glorious room. Servants and victuals aplenty, no domestic worries of any kind, hundreds of miles from importunity. And as I understand it, we simply go up and down in this spacious great bay. Delightful sailing, sure. Perhaps after dinner we may have some music." "With all my heart," said Jack. "I've scarcely touched my fiddle this month and more. By the way, I've invited Harding and one of the new mids, a boy called Gagan, whose father was kind to us in Bantry. Poor fellow. He's quite clever with figures, and he plays a creditable oboe, but he cannot be taught to coil down a rope like a Christian." "Listen," said Stephen, and once again it was apparent to Jack that his friend's mind was and had been elsewhere. "Listen, will you now? The Admiral, in his artless approach, let fall some words having a certain misty reference to the future, and they seem to me to chime with some of your indistinct deprecation to do with yellowing and your superstitious hatred of the colour itself, even. Be so good as to explain the matter in words adapted to the meanest understanding." "I was telling Sophie about it only the other day," said Jack, "so I hope I shall make it plain. Though things one's taken for granted all one's life, like the flowing of the tide, are hard to explain to those who don't know the meaning of high tide or low, like the natives of Timbuktu. Well, now, formerly, any man who was made a post-captain was sure of reaching flag rank by seniority, so long as he did nothing very wrong, or refused service more than once or twice. By service, I mean an offered command. When he reached the top of the captain's list, he would become a rear admiral of the Blue Squadron at the next promotion and hoist his flag at the mizzen. This was the absolute crown of a sea officer's career, and he could die happy. If, however, he lived on, he would, still by seniority, climb through the various grades and eventually become admiral of the fleet. But this tradition was broke in 1787. When a very deserving officer, Captain Balfour, was passed over. Since then, nothing's been the same. Now, many people are placed on the Navy list as retired captains, or, if this is too flagrantly unjust, then as rear admirals, but of no squadron whatsoever, and, of course, no command. When this happens, he's said to have been yellowed, to have been appointed to an imaginary yellow squadron. And if he's had the service at heart all his life, he cannot but die unhappy. I'm sure I should. It's an extremely public disgrace, and your friends hardly know how to meet your eye. But, my dear, you're quite far from the top of the list. Sure, you must have served some years more before you need worry about your flag. Certainly. But it's the running-up period that's so important. The time while the Admiralty are slowly making up their minds. The years when you must distinguish yourself if you possibly can, and when, above all, you must not put a foot wrong. Above all now, when there's a real danger of peace breaking out, with countless officers thrown on the beach, and commands as rare as needles in a haystack. I don't have to tell you, Stephen, how wholly I long to receive the order requesting and requiring me, as Rear Admiral of the Blue, to proceed to the smallest of commands, to His Majesty's sloop of war Mosquito, say, with 2 4-pounders and a swivel, and to hoist my flag in her mizzenmast. I should do anything for it, anything. Does Simmons Lee come within the limits of anything? No, of course not, Stephen. How can you be so strange? Well, it's an elastic term, you know. But, however, even if your fears are realized, that's not necessarily the end of your sea-going career. I made some very good friends in Chile, three of whom I met again in my recent travels across Spain, remarkably intelligent and well-informed men who very clearly saw the inevitable end of this war and the independence of their country. They are also aware of the very strong likelihood of rivalry between the liberated provinces, of attempts at the domination of Chile on the part of Peru, and the necessity for a Chilean navy, officers at least in part by very highly experienced men, victorious in almost all their encounters. What more suitable recruit than an admiral like you, even though he may have been yellowed by political jobbery? They sat in silence for some time, digesting this and the possibilities it contained. "There's Dead Man's Bay," said Jack, "and we're now in the Ras de Seine, a devilish passage in heavy weather. By dinner time, and I think I already hear Killick with the glasses, we should have the Point du Ras on our larboard quarter." Stephen nodded, and with a curiously knowing look, his head on one side, he asked, "Can you foretell the dark of the moon with reasonable accuracy?" "I believe so," said Jack. "Her motions are of some importance in navigation, you know, and we learn them quite early." "Well, I'm happy to hear you say so, for at the dark of the moon I must beg you to set me ashore, with a gentleman at present aboard the flagship, in a little cove just south of the same Point du Ras." Jack gazed over the sea. "Just how serious are these people?" he asked after a while.
"Deeply serious," said Stephen. "They are closely associated with O'Higgins and his friends. They are men of great substance in those parts, and they are wholly committed to independence. More serious you could not wish."
Another silence.
"The dark of the moon will be in 8 days, said Jack.
Chapter 5. For 5 days, no less, they simply went up and down the fine, spacious great bay, admiring the billows and fishing over the side. Delightful sailing indeed. And in the evening they played music until supper time or beyond. On the 6th day, misled by reports of a convoy coming up from Lorient, the inshore squadron sailed through the Passage du Ras once more, and across the Bay of Audierne to the farther point where they lay to, and sent the Ringle round to look into the harbour and inlets farther south. Captain Aubrey had dined in the wardroom, a wardroom which on this occasion included the Bellona's surgeon, a member, of course, by right. And now he was standing on the poop, drinking coffee with William Harding, the First Lieutenant, Captain Temple of the Royal Marines, Mr. Paisley, the purser, a convivial soul, a great hand at whist, and always willing to play sentimental ballads on his viola while others sang, together with Stephen and a few others. "There, Doctor," said Jack, pointing to a truly dreadful reef half a mile on their larboard beam. "There are the pen marks."
"I've often heard them mentioned," said Stephen,
always with strong disapprobation and even loathing.
"Scylla and Charybdis ain't in it with a strong southwester and a falling tide," said Jack.
"Nor the Gorgonzola, and that's Penmark Head beyond.
Look, that must have been a rough, wild night of it," he added to Harding.
"Indeed it was, sir," said Harding. "I never wish to see such another."
"I don't suppose you do," said Jack. "Doctor, do you know about the Droit de l'Homme?"
"A few things are more familiar to me than that amiable fiction. In my youth I wrote several versions, each more liberal than the last. In one I even included women, asserting that they were..."
The sailors smiled indulgently, and the purser said, "He means the man-of-war, Doctor.
A French 74. It was in the days of high revolutionary fervour in 96 or 97 when they gave ships names like that." "'The time of Hulsh's expedition to Ireland,' said Harding.
"'That I remember,' said Stephen, with a chill about his heart.
And then, feeling that something more was called for,
"'Will you tell me about it so?'
"'Pray do,' said the marine. "'I was in India at the time.'
"'Well,' said Harding, collecting his thoughts, "'it began a little before Christmas of the year 96 here in Brest. "'The French had gathered 17 of the line, 13 frigates, 6 brig corvettes, 7 transports and a powder ship. "'We were aware of their motions, of course, although we couldn't tell where they were going.' And Admiral Culpoise had a strong force off Ushant, while the inshore squadron was under Sir Edward Pellew in the Indefatigable 44. You remember, Doctor, that the Indefatigable was cut down from a two-decker, and she was a heavy frigate, carrying 24-pounders. I was a master's mate in her at the time. And under him he had 3 other frigates and a lugger. The Frenchmen came out, one after another, with a kindly east wind, 44 sail of them with something like 20,000 soldiers aboard, and they steered for the Passage du Raz to avoid Admiral Culpoise. But one struck on the Grand Stephen A just at the opening of the passage, and others went out by the Euroese, their admiral having changed his mind quite late in the day when dusk was falling. There was a shocking confusion of signals and lights and guns, but although Sir Edward sent to the Admiral and to Falmouth, they were never intercepted. Nope, they sailed on through fog and foul weather to Bantry Bay, where they had a perfectly appalling time of it, gale after gale, with ships driving from their anchors and being blown out to sea, frigates pitching forecastle under, foundering, impossible to land troops, food running out, and eventually most of them straggled back to France. There was a second rendezvous off the mouth of the Shannon. A few looked in, but only one stayed any length of time before seeing it was hopeless. And having found nobody at Bantry either, she steered not for Brest, like most of the others, but for some point south, probably Rochefort. She was commanded by Commodore Lacrosse, a right seaman, and we, Indefatigable and Amazon, 36, first saw her in thick weather about 3:30 in the afternoon of January the 13th, when we were in 47 degrees 30 minutes north, Ushant bearing northeast 50 leagues, a strengthening squally wind from the westward, and a heavy swell. She was some way to the northeast of us, and far from distinct, but presently we made out that she was a two-decker with no poop, her lower deck gun ports closed, obviously Les Doigts de l'Homme, known for swimming low in the water. And while everyone on the quarter-deck had her in their glasses, a squall hit her, carrying her main topsail braces and then her fore and main topmasts, which fell over her lee guns. They cleared away very quick, expecting us to attack on that side, but when we were within hail and under close-reefed topsails, Sir Edward hauled up the raker. Yet she hauled up too, and we exchanged broadsides. Prodigious musketry on her part from all the soldiers aboard. Then Sir Edward tried to cross her bows and rake her fore and aft. She foiled him again, and did all she could to run us aboard. In avoiding her, we showed our stern. But with her lower deck gun port so near the surface, and the very heavy roll of the ship with so little to steady her, courses and mizzen topsail was all she could spread, she did no great damage. Presently, when it was near full dark, Amazon came pelting up, fired her larboard broadside into the Doigts quarters at pistol shot, and then steered to cross her stern and give her the other. Again, the Doigts clapped her helm over, which brought us both on her less damaged leeward side, and we all blazed away until 7:30, still running southeast, the wind having backed a point or two. Then we and the Amazon shot ahead to knot and splice and fill more powder. We had the legs there, of course, with our topmast standing. An hour later, we were at it again, lying on our bows, one each side and yawing to rake her by turns, while she did much the same. She still steered very quick, giving us some hard knocks and trying to board. About 10:30, she cut away her wounded mizzen, and rather later we hauled off to secure our masts, their rigging being much shattered. But apart from that, the fire barely slackened until something after 4 in the morning, when the moon, breaking through the clouds, showed land close on board, and all 3 ships hauled as near to the wind as ever they could to avoid it. Yet just before dawn, there were breakers white on the lee bow. We wore ship, heading northwards. And when day broke, there was the land again, very close ahead and on the weather bow, with breakers to leeward. Warship to the southwards in 20 fathom water. And then, just after 7, there we saw her. There she lay, the Droit de l'Homme, right in with the land, broadside up with the tremendous surf beating clean over her. "Just there," he said, pointing, deeply moved by the strength of his recollections. "Just there, beyond that tall, pointed rock. At least 600 dead, they say. I'll not go into the horrors of war," he said with an embarrassed smile, conscious of having talked too much. "Anyhow, Doctor, you know much more about them than I do. The Amazon had gone ashore too, but farther along, farther in, and almost all her people were saved. The wind was right on the land, the tide was making, and there was nothing, nothing we could do for the Droit de l'Homme. We had 4 foot of water in the hold. We just managed to claw off, though we showed water terribly at one point, and though our people were so utterly exhausted they could scarcely haul the main sheet aft. We lay off for a while, putting the ship into some sort of order, while the surgeon and his mates looked after our wounded, and the cook got at least something for the hands to eat. And although the sea remained very high, the sky soon cleared over the penmarks of the land inshore. It was that which made me think of the Droit de l'Homme in the first place. The same very curious greenish light over the reef and land, all along from the Cape itself to Saint-Genolé, do you see? So I was taken to foretell heavy weather, and we certainly had a cruel time of it for the next week or 10 days. Mr. Harding spoke of a week or 10 days, did you not?
Asked Stephen.
I believe so, said Jack. May I trouble you for the marmalade? Oh, I beg pardon, cried Stephen as the ship gave a furious lee lurch and the jar flew from his hand. Killick! Killick there, swab in a damp cloth, and then another pot of marmalade. Not again, said Killick. Not again. The same yesterday, the same on Thursday, and that was with the poor bloody milk jug, too. All the forenoon watch on my bloody knees. Floor cloth never be itself again.
This in a mutter, in a louder voice from beneath the table.
Which there ain't no more orange marmalade neither.
When at last he'd gone away, Jack said, "Fortunately, it was only a common old pot, not that splendid Irish cut glass affair you so kindly gave us."
Yes, he did mention 10 days, but only in a manner of speaking, you know. These blows never go by the calendar. When this present tempest slackens, perhaps we shall have a post. I quite long to hear from Woolcombe, and indeed from London and Ballinasloe. Had been led to believe that one of the very few advantages of the Brest blockade was that it allowed the sufferers frequent supplies of fresh food and mail. To be sure, it is better in that line than, say, the New Holland station, but only in summer. Your informant, the man who led you into this high state of indignation, must have been thinking of the summer, not the season of equinoctial gales or the even more dreadful turning winter storms. But don't despair. The glass is rising quite evenly, so is the humidity. Tomorrow night, or the next, which is the dark of the moon, we may have one of the fogs this bay is so famous for, particularly as the wind is sure to fall. Indeed, it is less already.
Steady rain like this often deadens both wind and sea. When you've finished breakfast, will you not put on a Magellan jacket and take a turn on deck?
I will not. In the first place, because I dislike getting wet, and in the second, because I must complete my account of our sick berth, which Dr. Rutherford wished to recommend for universal adoption. And, of course, there are my medical notes. Yes, indeed.
When you reach any height at all, you spend more time scratching paper than anything else. Well, I've done with the reefers, Mr. Edwards, and I must attend to the fair writing of the log. And I have a score of returns to look over and sign. But after dinner, if it calms enough for you to sit to your cello, let's work our way through the new Bender piece. By all means, is there any more coffee in that pot? There was. And having poured it, Stephen said, I was talking to that boy Gagan, and I find that I know some of his relations in the Spanish service. His grandmother was a Fitzgerald. Will I tell you why he finds it so difficult to coil down a rope in a way that pleases his mentors? Is it not just natural inborn vice? It is not. Like many of his nation, he is a Chotog, a left-handed man. And left to himself, he will always coil a rope against the way of the sun. Then clearly he cannot be left to himself. Jack prosed on about the need for exact uniformity in the service, for all ropes to run smooth, on the dreadful results in an emergency of the contrary practice. And when he paused for a piece of toast, Stephen said, And there are degrees of left-handedness, some quite insuperable, others to be corrected, if that's the right term, though usually at a cost, sometimes very great, to the soul. The harp of Brian of the Tributes, High King of Ireland, and an unpersuadable man, carries the melody in the left hand. And this boy's oboe, made by his father, a skilful gentleman, from a length of bog oak, is the mirror image of the usual instrument. Would it be improper, do you think, to ask him to play with us? He blows the purest note. Indeed, I love an oboe. It has nothing of the clarinet's cloying sweetness. But as for your boy, he seems a modest, well-bred young fellow, to be sure. Yet I knew a reefer in the West Indies who was amazingly good at chess, could beat anyone. The Admiral, a pretty good player, invited him and was beat time and again. He laughed, but it didn't end happy. The boy got above himself, talked too much, gave himself airs, made himself so unpopular in the cockpit, and was kicked so very often that he had to be transferred. But I'll take particular note of young Gagan at 9 o'clock, and if it can properly be done, we might try. At 9 o'clock, the Bellona's young gentlemen who were not on duty attended in the captain's forecabin, washed, pink, brushed smooth, and properly dressed, together with Mr. Walkinshaw, the schoolmaster. "Good morning, sir," they cried, leaping up at the captain's entrance. "Good morning, sir," some gruff, some still shrill, some wavering horribly, a full octave. Jack desired them to sit down. Ordinarily, each, by order of seniority, would have shown up his workings, that's to say, his estimate of the ship's position, determined by observation of the sun's height at noon, or by double altitudes, by dead reckoning, and on occasion by a certain amount of copying from their more gifted messmates. But the weather of the last days had been such that no observation was possible, and Jack only required Mr. Walkinshaw to lead them through Pythagoras once again, calling upon each in turn to rehearse the theorems upon which this most elegant, satisfying, and wholly convincing argument was based. In his youth, Jack had been wretchedly taught, mere rule of thumb at the best, and it was only quite late that the beauty of Pythagoras and Napier's bones had been revealed to him, lighting a love of the mathematics that had burned steadily ever since. And he hoped that repeated exposure to them both might do the same for his youngsters. Generally speaking, it had answered for one or two boys in each commission, which would probably not have happened if he'd relied on ship's schoolmasters. The man he had at present, Mr. Walkinshaw, was better than most. He knew a fair amount about mathematics and navigation, and he was generally sober. But like most of his kind, he had very little authority. He messed with the midshipmen in the cockpit. He was little better paid than they. The regulations gave him no status in the ship, and he would have had to be an exceptional man to acquire one by force of character. Mr. Walkinshaw hadn't managed to do so. Andy's lessons were far quieter, more orderly and useful when the Almighty was present, listening most of the time, interposing on occasion, learning a great deal about the boys.
Today, his eyes rested more often on Gagan than the others. Again, he noticed his awkward, cramped, left-handed manner of writing, his modest way of answering a question, his smile when he was told that the answer was right. A smile that would have been enchanting if he'd been a girl. He's too pretty for his own good. Too pretty by far, Jack reflected. He'd be an odious little beast, was he aware of it? Fortunately, he ain't. Mr. Dormer, he said to a young gentleman whose attention seemed to be wandering, pray define a logarithm. Dormer blushed, straightened himself, and said, a logarithm, sir, is when you raise 10 to the power that gives the number you first thought of. After a few more answers of this kind, Jack desired Mr. Walkinshaw to return to his remarks on the principles of spherical trigonometry, and leafed through the rough copy of the Bellona's logbook that his clerk was to write fair later in the day, when the diminished sea might make fair writing more nearly possible.
Never say that I'm no weather prophet, said Jack, as he and Stephen sat down to dinner at a table that no longer required fiddles to keep the plates from one's lap. And I believe my fog is on its way. God love you for your words, my dear. I should have been sorely vexed to miss my rendezvous. Yet it mustn't be too thick, for although our Brittany pilot knows the bay like his own bed, he has to have a terminus a quo and a terminus ad quem. He gave Stephen a satisfied look and paused. But Stephen's face, civilly attentive, showed no change whatsoever. And Jack, never one to bear resentment, went on. He's marking Ramillies's chart at present. By the way, I asked Ramillies to dinner today. We have an enormous great fat goose, but he begged to be excused. He's taking medicine. This meant that at 7 bells in the morning watch, the Ramillies's captain had stuffed himself with rhubarb, brimstone, the inspissated juice of figs, and any other cathartics that happened to be at hand, so that he would be confined to the seat of ease in his quarter gallery, groaning and straining for the greater part of the day, clearly unfit as a guest at a dinner table. I wonder that a man of Captain Fanshawe's intelligence, education, and taste should persist in that deleterious, superstitious self-torment, said Stephen in a tone of real indignation. It is one of the unhappiest legacies of dark ages, of mere barbarity. Oh, said Jack, but William Fanshawe studied health, you know. And he understands more about it than most, I do assure you. He's a great reader, and he has a book by a man called Pigott, who was all for the superiority of vegetables over bread, and who maintained that caps were far, far better for you than hats. His arguments, as I recall, were wonderfully convincing, to do with the humours. This was not the first time that Stephen had learned about medicine from sea officers. As usual, he merely bowed, and at much the same moment, the enormous great fat goose came in, Killick bearing it against the swell with a very fixed expression indeed on his face, and setting it down without a drop of the abundant grease astray. When the massive remains of the bird, expertly carved by Stephen, had been sent down to the midshipman's berth according to the humane naval custom, and when the port was going to and fro, Jack said, I considered your young fellow this morning, and I think we might try. In these cases there's always the danger that if it don't answer it may do the boy or young man harm. I have known cases. Yet I think here we might try. Do you know the Mozart oboe quartet in F major? Yes, sir.
Of course you do, cried Jack. I was only calling it to mind. No, what I mean is that I should love to hear it again. And Paisley's a respectable hand with a viola. We played it in Funchal with those cheerful Portuguese friars, and again, where? I forget. But I do remember that the viola broke a string in its most important passage, and we were all thrown into a sad confusion, a sudden loss of all cohesion, the ground dropping from beneath one's feet.
Anticlimax is far too weak an expression. Naples. It was off Naples. The oboe was a castrato from the opera, and John Hill of the Leviathan played the viola, at least as far as we went. I remember the grief of it. No spare strings. Stephen, may I beg you to ask Paisley whether he'd like to study the score? Coming from me, it would be so very like an order, and he is, after all, your messmate. And do you think you could find out whether the boy would be capable of bearing his part, whether he'd like to try? And if so, whether he too would choose to have the score? Don't take it amiss, Stephen, but these things would come so much better from a man who can clap leeches to their temples, or rouse out their liver and lights, for their own good, of course, than from a fellow who cannot be contradicted and whose prime function is to command. I put it very badly, I find. Don't be offended, Stephen. I don't really believe in all this gold lace. I don't really esteem myself another pompous pilot or Alexander the Great. Never in life, my dear. As for young Gagin, I understand that chamber music has been part of his family life since he was a little boy. And as for the purser, I know that he plays in his parish choir when he's ashore, and that although in the wardroom it's mostly Vauxhall and Ranelagh airs, he's perfectly capable of other things. Now, pouring each another glass of wine, pray tell me about this Brittany pilot. Oh, he's one of the fishermen Calliope picked up when she was rescuing people who were trying to escape after the Vendée fighting. Royalists, of course. Just so. I presume they've been carefully sieved. Oh, I'm sure of it. They've been with us, scattered about the fleet ever since. And I believe that during the peace they brought their families across to Market Jew in Cornwall. They have the same kind of language, as I'm sure you know, and they get along famously with the country people and fishermen. This one is called Jan. The Admiral sent him over some little time ago to mark all our charts. He's marking Ramillies now, and he should be with us tomorrow. So much the better. Stephen finished his glass and said, I shall make my rounds now, and if the sea grows even a little more reasonable, I believe we may have some music after supper. And if the rounds don't take long, I shall have made my inquiries well before that. Well, my dear, he said, coming in just before their toasted cheese, an invariable supper dish whenever they were within reach of the prime essentials, that was eminently satisfactory. I found the boy by mere chance, and he puzzling over a knot with his sea daddy. Are you acquainted with the expression? Fairly well. My own sea daddy, dear old William Parsons, was the best of men, endlessly patient. So was this one. Again and again he said, no, sir. Right over left and then up through the bight without any wounding emphasis. And when at last the knot was tied, he said that Nelson couldn't have done it better. That Mr. Gagin would make a seaman yet. He then walked off to stow the rope wherever ropes are stowed, and I talked to the boy. Of course he knew the quartet, had played it repeatedly at home, his father with the cello, his uncle Kevin the fiddle, and cousin Patrick the viola, but should be very happy to look over the score again. Mr. Paisley was almost as good. He didn't absolutely assert that he'd borne a part in this particular quartet, but he let it be understood that he was intimately familiar with it, and even if he hadn't been, he was, as the skipper himself would testify, so practised a sight-reader that he didn't need to study the score before sitting down to it, so long as he had a good light on his music stand. Certainly I have known him make his way through a sheaf of handwritten sheets seen for the very first time in a very creditable manner. What? Joy! Allow me to help you to some of this capital-smelling cheese, if you would be so good. What you tell me of tomorrow's weather, is it likely to be suitable? I will swear to nothing. But Harding and the master, who both know Ushant well, are of the same opinion. Unless it grows so thick that we cannot see our music, why then tomorrow, touching wood, should be all that a reasonable being could ask. And indeed, the four reasonable beings could hardly have been better served.
There was still a heavy swell from the southwest, and urged on by the making tide, it broke high, white and dreadful, on the islands and reefs of the Saints and the mainland cliffs. But the wind had dropped to no more than a topgallant breeze, and although Jack's fog had made its infant appearance in the form of a veiling mist, there was no question of its blurring even a hemi-demi-semi-quaver. Yet when Jack and Stephen met for breakfast, each looked at the other with a considering eye, and Stephen said, "Melancholy, brother?" "Hipped?"
"Somewhat," said Jack. "I don't much like the behaviour of the glass," pointing to an elegant barometer and brass gimbals. "Nor do I much care for poverty. I cannot afford to keep a table for my officers. I cannot afford to entertain my fellow captains in the traditional service fashion. And what is more, I cannot afford to buy extra powder to eke out our miserable allowance. Today, to the astonishment of one and all, we shall beat to quarters and carry out the great gun exercise. But your only worthwhile exercise is with the true discharge, the furious recoil, the cloud of smoke. And even on this perfect day, we can afford only 2 real broadsides for each battery. But, Stephen, you're in much the same case, I believe. Haunted by the Blue Devils? Glum? That's nothing that coffee and perhaps a very lightly boiled egg will not bear away," said Stephen. "Yet I am saddened by the reflection that although age has not yet seriously decayed my powers in other directions, or so I flatter myself, I have real difficulty in grasping the geography of this behemoth of a vessel. The sick bay I know perfectly well, the wardroom, and this series of booths and cabins, but when I walk about at haphazard, as I was doing when I chanced upon young Gagan, I grow strangely bemused, scarcely knowing front from back, whereas in the dear surprise, bless her, by all means, I knew every recess, however remote, and, of course, all the people. Here, I'm something of a stranger in a largely unknown city. I don't find my not inconsiderable maritime knowledge increases, and I am by no means sure that the bold figure of speech I heard directed by an aged quartermaster and a ship's boy, 'Thou wilt never shit a seaman's turd,' may not be applied to me." "Never in life," cried Jack. "You're the most seaman-like ship's surgeon I've ever known. Never in life. Killick! Killick, there! Light along that goddamn coffee, for heaven's sake!" "Which," began Killick. But seeing the captain's face, he closed his mouth and the door. "Not at all, Stephen. You ought to consider you've not been aboard very long. And for most of the last commission, you were either looking after the sick or travelling about the African wilderness collecting rarities, except when you were sick yourself, very sick, very nearly dead, or so weak as to be able to do no more than creep about the poop." "Killick! Which it's coming, ain't it?"
cried Killick from behind his loaded tray.
"With a 2-minute this morning's egg for his honour."
Breakfast did indeed sweep away a good deal of superficial melancholy. And after it they walked up the poop, watching the sun rise round and orange over France. What mist there was, and it was thickening, didn't yet hide all the ships of the inshore squadron, and Jack pointed them out in the stations where Fanshawe, his senior by 6 months and therefore in command, had placed them. "There's Ramillies, right in the middle of the Iroese Passage," he said, nodding towards a rosy haze of topsails almost due north. "And if you were to jump up to the masthead and clear the haze away, you'd see one of the frigates, probably Phoebe, guarding the way out of the Passage du Four. A good many vessels try to get into Brest from the north that way. And between the frigate and Ramillies you can make out a cutter even now, Fox, I believe, lying there to pass on signals." He ran through the meagre tale of ships posted off most of the important means of access, just as the Bellona was posted within gunshot of the Ras de Seine. And among other things, he showed him the general position of the uncharted or badly charted rock upon which HMS Magnificent struck in the year 4, on Lady Day in the year 4. A total loss. But her people were all saved by the boats of the squadron, mostly from the Impetia, as I recall. "Mr. Harding," he said to his hovering first lieutenant. "I believe you wish to speak to me."
"Yes, sir," said Harding, stepping forward and taking off his hat. "I beg pardon for interrupting you, sir, but the Nimble is finding it hard to stem the tide, and if we want any effect of surprise among the people, perhaps we might call for the targets right away."
"Make it so, Mr. Harding, make it so."
And to Stephen, "How I ramble on." He rambled no longer. The Nimble had been anxiously watching the Bellona's upper rigging, and as soon as the signals broke out, her boat shoved off, towing their targets. "We'll beat to quarters, Mr. Harding, if you please," said Jack, and almost instantly the drum volleyed and thundered. Some few of the newer, heavier Bellonas hadn't caught the signs of the coming exercise. The gunner's very particular attention to his charges, the captains of the gun crew's sly checking of tackles, tackle falls, trucks, ladles, rammers, sponges, worms, and their absent-minded easing of the tompions. And those few were properly amazed by the din. But by now all, except the very, very stupid landsmen, at least knew their action stations, and they ran to them, while the very few exceptions were kindly guided by the boatswain's mates. Dr. Maturin's station was, of course, the after cockpit, and here he stood with his assistants, William Smith and Alexander Macaulay, together with a few unsatisfactory makeshift loblolly boys, farrier's apprentices or out-of-work slaughterhouse hands. And in this space, bare except for instrument racks and the chests of the midshipmen, its usual inhabitants, heaved together, and lashed to form an operating table, they stood silently listening. The three foremost upper-deck starboard 18-pounders bore on the leading target almost at the same moment and fired with a triple crash that made the hanging lanterns tremble. They were instantly followed by the huge, much deeper voices of the gun-deck 32-pounders. And for the next 5 minutes the entire hull was filled with a great bellowing din, so confused that no separate discharge other than those directly overhead could be distinguished. At the same time powder smoke came below, wafting its heady smell about them. Then, all at once, a deafened silence, followed by the rumble of guns being housed.
"Sir," cried William Smith, much too loud, "I saw a very curious thing. Whenever there was a split second between the explosions just over us, each produced a different tremor in the smoke. You could distinctly see it against the lit edge of the lantern."
He spoke with something of the excitement of battle, and with much the same freedom, Macaulay said that he did hope it had been a satisfactory exercise. There was such an agreeable feeling in the ship when they'd done well.
Before Stephen could reply, the first of the casualties came down the after-hatch carried by his teammates. A young marine who'd been stationed in one of the after 32-pounders to help run her up, she weighed about 3 tons, and who had misjudged the speed and force of the recoil.
"A very moderate tourniquet for 20 minutes, Mr. Macaulay, if you please," said Stephen, sewing up the gash, "and a spiker bandage, but by no means tight."
Macaulay had been dresser to a famous London surgeon, and his bandages were marvels of regularity, the admiration of all the seamen. But regularity was often cousin to constraint, itself close kin to gangrene. In the early days of a commission, when many of the pressed men were still sad lobcocks without discernment or sea legs, it was usual for these exercises to cause a fair amount of damage. So much so that when Stephen returned to the quarter-deck, Jack asked, "What was the butcher's bill this time?"
"A few sprains and rope burns," said Stephen, "and one flesh wound. A strip of gastrocnemius, more spectacular than grave. As I sewed it up, I reflected upon gangrene, always a possibility, and upon an interesting treatment that I discussed aboard the flag." Yet as he spoke he remembered his friend's odd squeamishness about some aspects of medicine, and even more of surgery, and broke off to exclaim at the smoke bank from their exercise, still remarkably solid and coherent, there away to leeward. "A satisfactory exercise, I trust?"
"Tolerably, sir, I thank you, for what very little it amounts to. Scarcely more than 2 full broadsides. Still, with so many well-trained crews, it was reasonably accurate and pretty brisk, roughly the equivalent of 2.5 minutes. And after all, the Royal George sank the Superb in Quiberon Bay with only 2 broadsides. Very heavy weather indeed, and not one of her 600 people saved. They fell silent, both thinking of an earlier command, the Leopard, which sank a Dutch man of war in the high southern latitudes also with the loss of all hands. One or two messengers reached the captain, who dealt with him in a firm, competent, official voice. Then, turning to Stephen, he said in an undertone, "I'm so looking forward to our concert tomorrow." So is Stephen. But he was concerned for the prime performer, the oboe, the essence of their meeting. From the dispensary, far aft on the orlop deck, where he and William Smith spent some of the next forenoon grinding quicksilver, hog's lard, and mutton suet together to make blue ointment, he could hear Gagan practising in the nearby midshipman's berth, playing scales, changing his reeds, and venturing upon some of the more remarkable flights open to a well-tempered oboe. The Bellona had a reasonably good-natured set of midshipmen and master's mates, 12 of them, mostly the sons of friends and former shipmates. Certainly the younger members of the berth showed no obvious signs of oppression, and although Gagan was probably the youngest there, just old enough to be admitted to the berth rather than entrusted to the gunner with the youngsters, he clearly never hesitated to play serious, difficult music there. This was the more curious because of his somewhat anomalous position. He'd been born on the books of several ships commanded by his father's friends or relatives in order to gain nominal sea time without actually going afloat. A fairly common practice, but one that brought the young gentlemen aboard with so little knowledge of their profession that they were something of a burden to their shipmates. Often unpopular, sometimes cruelly treated, but... Yet this was not the case with Gagan. "Of course, he's a very good-looking boy," observed Stephen. "Perhaps that has something to do with it. One has an innate, wholly disinterested kindness for beauty." The ointment was now made, and Smith carried off a suitable number of gallipots for their syphilitic patients. Stephen shut and double-locked the dispensary door. Seamen were much given to dosing themselves. And hearing the main body of reefers leave their berth with a sound like that of a herd of mad cattle, he walked in. "Good day, sir," said Gagan, leaping up.
"And a very good day to you, Mr. Gagan," said Stephen. "Please, may I see your instrument again?" It was a beautiful oboe, formed from the most elegant, dark, dark wood. But neither praise of its appearance nor of its lovely tone seemed to give much pleasure, and Stephen returned to their earlier talk of Bantry Bay, the country round it, including the Reverend Mr. Gagan's parish, and their common acquaintances. The boy was perfectly polite, perfectly well-bred, but it was clear that he didn't wish for any close contact at this moment, nor any comfort for his evident anxiety. In the civilest way, he was saying that he was not to be manipulated, nor to be made to be easy in his mind when he was not easy in his mind, however kind the intention. "He's a respectable boy," said Stephen, walking off. "But I could wish he were not quite so tense. Were it not for some illogical and even perhaps superstitious reluctance, respect for innocence, I should prescribe 15 or even 20 drops of laudanum." Laudanum, the alcoholic tincture of opium, a delightful tawny liquid that had floated Dr. Maturin through many a bout of the most extreme anxiety and distress, though at a moral and spiritual cost that eventually became exorbitant. It was now replaced by moderate use of the Peruvian coca leaf. The boy was tenser still when he appeared at the door of the captain's cabin, carrying his oboe in a green baize bag, as the last stroke of 5 bells in the afternoon watch was struck. The berth had done him proud.
Not only was he as popular as a boy who was no seaman could very well be, but his appearance would reflect upon the credit of the after cockpit as a whole, including Callahan and three other master's mates, and that almost godlike figure, William Reed, who had so often sailed with the captain before, losing an arm in battle in the East Indies. And now his hair, having been strongly brushed, was tied so tight behind that it stretched his features into a look of astonishment, while his face shone pink from an almost entirely superfluous shave. The brass buttons on his best blue coat outshone even those on his captain's uniform, while the white patches on his collar, called by some quarterly accounts and by others the mark of Cain, would have put virgin snow to shame. "There you are, Mr. Gagan," cried Jack. "I'm very happy to see you. Come and have a glass of sherry." After the sherry, they sat down to a dish of codlings caught over the side that morning, to a pair of roast fowls with bacon and a great many sausages, to a noble apple pie and to the best part of a cheddar cheese. The midshipman's berth usually dined at noon, and Gagan, after a hesitant beginning, laid into his food with a wolfish concentration, replying, "If you please, sir," to any suggestion of more. "The young gent has ate 11 potatoes," said Killick to his mate, passing the empty dish. "Go and see if the wardroom left any." At last, when the cloth had been drawn and the king's health drunk in a glass of port suited to a very young head, they took their coffee and ratafia biscuits, the sea-going equivalent of petit four, in the great cabin, where the cello, the viola, and the fiddle leaned by their respective music-stands, well lit by the great stern window, a suffused grey near brilliance, with the ship standing west-sou-west under reef topsails, making little more than steerage way on a gently rolling sea. "Another cup, Mr. Paisley?" asked Jack. "Mr. Gagan?" "Then, in that case, perhaps we should set to." They spread their scores, and as they did so, Stephen remembered with some concern that in the F major quartet the opening notes were played by the oboe alone. But when, after the necessary squeaking and grunting as the stringed instruments tuned themselves, Jack smiled at Gagan and nodded, these same crucial notes came out clear and pure with no overemphasis, a beautiful round tone in which the strings joined almost at once. And almost at once they were a quartet, playing happily along with as nearly perfect an understanding as was possible on so short an acquaintance. With scarcely a pause they swam through the elegant melancholy of the adagio, Jack Aubrey particularly distinguishing himself, and Stephen booming nobly. But it was in the rondo that the oboe came wholly into its own, singing away with an exquisite gay delicacy infinitely enjoyed by all four. And to all four, in spite of the music before them, it seemed to last for an indefinite space before coming to the perfect simplicity of its end.
"Well done! Well done indeed!" cried Jack, leaning forward and shaking Gagan's hand. "What a glorious pipe you blow, upon my word and honour! I've rarely enjoyed music more, if ever, indeed!"
Gagan blushed extremely, but before he could answer there was an imperative knock at the door, and Mr. Edwards, the captain's clerk, came in with an untidy, disparate sheaf of papers in his hand. "Sir," he said, "here are the memorandums we were to send to the flag, just your rough notes. You said you'd read them for me to copy fair. The boat here has been this half-glass, and he's growing outrageous."
"By God," cried Jack, "it clean slipped my mind. Gentlemen, forgive me, I beg, but had we gone on, we couldn't possibly have done better. I thank you all very heartily indeed."
They filed out, with proper acknowledgements and in due order of rank. Gagan, standing back to let Stephen pass, looked at him with open affection,
all constraint and tension gone. And with Edward settled at a desk, Jack began from his informal and often cryptic notes. "Purser, provisions for 9 weeks full of all species except wine, of that only 39 days. Master, 113 tons of water, beef very good, pork sometimes shrinks in the boiling, the rest of the provisions very good. In cutting up provisions, master's mate, bosun's mate, captain forecastle, captain tops and quartermaster. Pretty well supplied with stores, rigging and sails in good order, 2 pair of main shrouds cut in the eyes, gunner, 18 rounds of powder filled, plenty of wads, 40 rounds, carpenter, hull in good state, knee of the head supported by 2 cheeks, masts and yards in good state, pretty well stored." That was a very glorious piece. "The glorious piece of the world, indeed," said Stephen, as he and Gergan separated outside the wardroom. The purser had already gone forward.
"So it was, too," said Gergan, "and how I admired the captain's double stopping."
"Yours, too, sir. But I'm glad it didn't go on. It was perfect like that. And I was afraid that if we started again it might take a great while, and I should miss the last dog."
"A particularly amiable creature, I make no doubt."
"Oh, sir,"
said Gergan with that delicate kindness the young sometimes reserve for the old, ignorant and stupid.
"I should have said watch. The last dog watch. The second of those short ones at the end of the day, you know. When we're going along under a very moderate sail, and there's nothing much to do, no possibility of all hands being called, we reefers, whose watch isn't on deck, often play about aloft. We call it skylarking."
"I've heard of it."
"Indeed, I've not infrequently seen the phenomenon. Yet it's not invariably confined to the young and light built. Captain Aubrey and Admiral Mitchell once raced to the topmost point of a vessel whose name escapes me for a dozen of champagne."
"Heavens, sir, pray who won?"
"Oh, faith, the Admiral said he did.
And who's to contradict an Admiral, a senior? Superiores, priores, you know."
"Yes, indeed, sir. But if you'll excuse me now, sir, I must go below and store my pipe and change my clothes. Old Dormer and I are to see which can touch the main t'gallant truck first."
Gergan ran down the ladder, and in the lightness of his heart he kicked both his best silver-buckled shoes far into the cockpit. Callahan was the only other person in the berth. He was writing a letter by the light of a purser's dip, writing with close concentration to his young woman. But he looked up and asked how dinner in the cabin had gone.
"Oh, very well indeed, once I got started. Codlings, of course, and then a pair of huge